This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also listen to over at progressive.org. Today, it's a real honor to have on the show with me the fine actor Roscoe Orman, who for the past 32 years has played Gordon on Sesame Street. But on top of that, he's played lots of different roles. He's appeared on Sanford and Son, Kojak, All My Children, A Man Called Hawk, Law and Order, Cosby, and Sex and the City. And he starred in such plays as Fences, Do Lord Remember Me, and The Confessions of Stephen Fetchett. He's also been in such films as Willie Dynamite, FX, and Full Court Press. Roscoe Orman now has a fascinating memoir out entitled Sesame Street Dad, Evolution of an Actor. Roscoe Orman, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt. It's good to be here.
It's a pleasure. It's kind of a thrill. How'd you get into acting?
Well, I actually come from a line of performers in my family, in a sense. My grandfather on my mother's side was a song and dance man in the early days of the Harlem Renaissance period. Performed at the old original Lafayette Theater, singing and dancing. And I remember just hearing those stories from him. He had to give up that career when he started his family and you know, get real jobs to pay for his family. But he, I could tell just from those stories that it was just the light in his eyes just really struck me as, you know, made me realize that this was such an important and joyful part of who he was. So I kind of carried that spirit with me throughout my childhood. I was in school plays and sang in the chorus in whatever schools I was attending.
Did you recognize or was it recognized by others that you had a gift?
To some extent, yeah. I was always cast in the lead roles in plays and sang solo in the choruses, especially when I got to high school. But even then, I never really thought of it as a career choice necessarily. In high school, I was actually on a track towards the visual arts. It had been discovered in the fifth grade that I had a special skill for drawing, and had a scholarship to art classes on the weekends, and then I went to a special high school called the High School of Art and Design in New York City.
Do you still draw, by the way?
I still do. As a matter of fact, my next book is a children's book that I've illustrated as well.
That must be written.
Yeah. In my last year of high school, my senior year, this part-time teacher who was actually a choreographer and a writer and first-time theater producer with her husband, they were putting together a musical review, topical musical review in the 60s about some of the issues of the day in terms of the civil rights movement and
the war hadn't really broken.
No, this was definitely the McCarthy era that was. We were on the tail end of that, so there was the bomb shelter scare. I mean, people were really into all of that, and you know, several other topical things. The whole emergence of television as this kind of a purveyor of mediocrity in America, you know, and they targeted all these things, and they had this cast of teenagers singing and acting and dancing in this show, and I joined the cast my last year in high school. So I was actually performing professionally before I graduated, and I realized in the course of that wow, this, you know, if I could do this, and they said that I definitely had what it would take to have a career in this field. So,
and you stayed then in New York?
I stayed in New York, and I began studies at various schools for theater, at Circle in the Square Theater School and Manhattan School of Music for singing, and then Alvin Ailey Dance Theater for dance. And
well, you did it all, huh?
Yeah. I said I'm going for the whole thing, and I loved all of it. It was really, you know, it wasn't a matter really ever of my seeking fame and fortune. It was a matter of this is something I really love to do, and I was just swept up in it.
And where, what is the thing that is most gratifying? Where is that love located, if you will? Is it, I know some people do it for the applause. I mean, mm-hmm. Bob Hope once said he hated going on vacations because the fish don't clap. But I'm wondering where that is for you. Is it in just getting into someone else's character?
It's both. It's really, as an actor, it's extremely liberating to be able to shed your own skin and get into someone else's and just explore a whole other life, you know, and actually lend yourself totally to that each night as a theater actor, and in communion with your fellow actors and the audience in this kind of, you know, this entire immediate sense of exploration together, which I think any great theater actor or even good theater actor will tell you that there's no comparison between that and working on film or television.
I'm speaking with Roscoe Orman, who has played Gordon for 32 years on Sesame Street and has done a lot of acting in New York and elsewhere in plays. You were there in the 60s at a time of great ferment, not only politically but culturally, mm-hmm. and the rise of black theater in New York. And you mention in your book, Sesame Street Dad, the influence and importance of Leroy Jones, as he used to be called, Amiri Baraka. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about him and what his influence was.
Well, I first met Leroy Jones very near the beginning of my career. I had done a few plays off-Broadway and had doing classes at not at the Circle in the Square, but my teacher, Michael Kahn, who went on to be the head of Juilliard's School of Drama, had a private workshop for some of his better students. And it was during that time that I first met Jones. His play Dutchman was running off Broadway, which really, it was like the third play of his to run within that 1 or 2 year period off Broadway in New York, and had really...
this is a powerful political play, too.
Powerful, powerful. My first experience with a play of that type, or any artistic expression that had such a forceful political, cultural dynamic to it. I actually, since I was in the workshops with Michael, I studied the role of Clay. It's basically a two-character play with Clay, a young black student, and a young white woman that he encounters on the subway trains of New York. And in the course of working on that play, it was my first real encounter with that kind of revelation of my own sense of development politically and culturally, and from a very personal sense, because this character was of my generation, of my time, and really expressed some of the anger, the frustration, the searching for self, you know, that that my generation was definitely in the throes of at that time.
I'm speaking with Roscoe Orman, who has a memoir out now, a really fascinating book called Sesame Street Dad: Evolution of an Actor. Roscoe Orman is probably known to most of you as Gordon from Sesame Street, but he's got an interesting background and has done a lot of other interesting things too. You went and pursued some of these acting political combinations when you joined something that I hadn't really known much about before, and that's called the Free Southern Theater, mm-hmm. somehow connected to Freedom Summer and some of those other activities. Yes. Yeah. In the civil rights movement in the 60s. Tell me about that.
Well, in early 65, I was doing a show in New York City at the Gramercy Arts Theater with a mentor and kind of idol of mine, Oscar Brown Jr., who is a Chicago songwriter and singer and poet. It was a show called The Worlds of Oscar Brown Jr., and we were performing his material, and the Village Voice had an article 1 week that he showed me, and the article, it was like a 2 or 3 page article on this group of actors and directors and writers who were touring the Deep South. This was at the height of the Civil Rights Movement. They were called the Free Southern Theater. The theater was founded by two young black students, one Gilbert Moses from Cleveland, Ohio, and the other John O'Neill from Carbondale, Illinois, had gone south as part of the civil rights. John had joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. Gilbert was with the Mississippi Freedom Press. He was a writer. And they came up with the idea of starting this theater, which would speak to the issues that were inherent in this movement. And they did that first season in 1964, which was that Freedom Summer in Mississippi. And this article had pictures of it. It had interviews with them and talked about the work they were doing. And
so you just picked up and left?
I said, wow, this is amazing. And I told Oscar, you know, I said, you know, I got to go there. I mean, I'm sorry, and this is a great show. You know, I mean, I'm having a great time, but this is where I belong, you know. So just so happened that John O'Neill was coming to New York. I contacted them. He was coming to interview prospective actors and company members for the next season in 65, and I went and met him, and it was just a mutual, you know, connection there. And by the spring of 65, I had arrived in New Orleans.
Well, you weren't there long before a harrowing little racist incident occurred that you experienced in New Orleans. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. Actually, I had just been there less than a few weeks when I was moving in. The day that I actually moved my few belongings into my residence with my roommate, Murray Levy, who was a really revolutionary guy in the old Bolshevik sense of came from a long line of Russian Jewish revolutionary.
It's a red diaper baby.
Yeah,
Russian and, red too.
Yeah, and Murray and I had moved our things into this French Quarter apartment on the second floor, and we had help from a few other newcomers that year. Murray had spent a year already. He was there for the first year, so he was the veteran. The other two guys and myself were new. A guy named Robert Cordier, who was a 30-something-year-old Belgian director, who'd come to direct some plays that season, and our new technical director, David McLaughlin, who was the son of a Massachusetts judge who'd ridden down on his Harley-Davidson. And we... after moving all the things into the apartment, we decided to get a beer at the local pub right down the street, and we walked in there and sat on the stools and sat there, and we sat there, and we sat, and we waited. And finally, we realized that, you know, something's wrong here. And the barmaid eventually came over and, in a very terse way, without even looking at us, said, "I can't serve y'all." And she walked away, and we said, oh, this is what it's like. Before we knew what had happened, someone had called the police, and before we could hit the front door, the place had been surrounded by the New Orleans Police Department. We were all thrown up against the wall, handcuffed, searched, and incarcerated.
And the police said some really racist things to you,
yeah,
to boot.
Yeah, they're very racist, you know, just words that I had never really heard, you know, directly. I mean, growing up in the Bronx.
I mean, the ugliness does just kind of leap off the page when you get it in this memoir of yours, Roscoe Orman, yeah. Sesame Street Dad. Roscoe Orman plays Gordon on Sesame Street, and he was in New Orleans here in 1965 with the Southern Freedom Theater, Free Southern Theater, mm-hmm. excuse me, and he had this experience. But then you didn't run away. You stayed there for a couple years.
No, as a matter of fact, I stayed for two seasons. And that experience really drove home to me why we were there. You know, it just gave me that first full, you know, experience, full frontal experience of what it was like to be a black person in the Deep South, you know, and what it must have been like for the entire lives of you know, millions of people who grew up there and spent their lives there.
And so did you do plays from city to city in the South?
We did plays throughout the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, Tennessee, and Alabama.
And how were you received?
For the most part, our audiences were comprised of the black communities, you know, in these small towns in these little, you know, farming communities, and other freedom workers, you know, who were basically the only whites who would come unless they were, you know, spies from the White Citizens Council, the Klan, who would come and you know, sometimes cause some havoc. We had a few really hairy incidents of people. One time, three company members were arrested and then released without their car and chased through the woods by the Klan. You know,
the suggestion in the book is the police tipped the Klan off.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, they were probably the same people.
Could have been the same people, yeah. At night with the sheets on.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
You left after a couple of years. You came back to New York, Roscoe Orman, and you did some more theater work in Black Theater in New York, including at the new Lafayette Theater, where you said your grandfather was there,
grandfather,
so that must have been interesting.
Right. That was a really incredible dynamic for both of us. You know, my grandfather was still living then, and he actually came to see that first production that I did. I starred in a play called Who's Got His Own.
And fast forward for me to Sesame Street and how you arrived on Sesame Street.
Yeah, well, I actually, just before Sesame Street, I had gone out to Hollywood and done my first Hollywood film experience. Played the title role in a movie called Willie Dynamite, which is was part of what has since been described as the blaxploitation era.
Do you not like that term?
I don't think there was anything exploitive about that experience for those of us who were breaking into the film industry. I think it was an opportunity for us to work our way up into probably more prominent positions within the industry creatively and in terms of work. Similar, I always thought to the B movies of the 1930s with Cagney and Bogart and those kind of guys who were doing basically the same kinds of films. They were gangster films, you know, not very, you know, high artistic
shoot 'em up films.
Kind of shoot 'em up, yeah, you know. And it was fun. I had a really great time learning how to act in film, which does have a different set of requirements in terms of that kind of the performing skills, you know, that are brought to bear. So I was a little disappointed that it didn't lead to other Hollywood films, but this was a time before the careers of people like Morgan Freeman and Denzel Washington. Those kinds of opportunities didn't exist.
There weren't a lot of doors open then.
No. So I came back to New York and I was doing theater again. To my delight, and I was in a play at the Manhattan Theater Club in New York called The Sirens, and a friend of mine who was actually the brother of my director, and he also was a director, a TV director named Stan Lathan, who later went on to produce and direct shows like The Rock TV series with Charles Dutton and Deaf Poetry Jam and Deaf Comedy Jam with Russell Simmons. And he came backstage and mentioned that they were looking for someone to replace an actor on a children's show for which he had been working for some time, and asked if I'd be interested. At the time, my wife and I were expecting our first child, so I figured, well, you know, a TV job might not be a bad idea, but a kid's show, I don't know. You know, so I went and I had a meeting with John Stone and Dave Connell, who were the producers, and I immediately realized that this was not your typical TV kids show. These guys were really, especially John Stone, was obviously an ex-hippie who had brought that sensibility to this whole other genre of, you know, television and for kids in a very imaginative, creative, thoughtful way. Joan Ganz Cooney had created this company called the Children's Television Workshop, and Sesame Street was the first project that they undertook.
I read that you hadn't ever seen the show before you auditioned for it, and it had been on for several years, I think five years.
Yeah. So it was quite a surprise when I met them and realized that this was not Romper Room or Captain Kangaroo. It was a little something more than that. Yeah.
And now, 32 years later, you're still playing Gordon. How is that experience affected you?
Well, it just so happened that the same year that I became Gordon, I became a real-life dad with the first of my four children. My wife and I have had four over a span of, in terms of birth, over 20 years. We had four kids, so there's quite a spread there. So it seemed like I always had a kid who was watching Sesame Street at home while I was doing Gordon.
It must have been kind of freaky for the kids, too.
Yeah. Well, they...
And some of them were on the set, too.
They've all been on the show, you know, with me at one time or another, especially my son, who is 21 now, but at the age of 11 months became the adopted son of Gordon and Susan on the show. And so he spent... he had a recurring role. So he spent a lot of time with me in the studio, and it was great for that kind of bonding experience for him and myself during those years, for him to be able to come to work with me and, you know, hang out and get to know who my friends were. And actually, he became even better friends with the Muppets than I was.
You write in the book, Roscoe Orman, Sesame Street Dad, that it's an important role. You viewed it as an important role. You recognized right away the mm-hmm. importance of it in overcoming stereotypes that have been so common in Hollywood since the beginning of Hollywood and mm-hmm. and still infect the media to some extent. Has that been a burden to carry?
Well, there is a sense of responsibility attached to, I think, anyone's career in the arts. I think you have to have a certain sense of ethics attached to whatever you do. But I think for artists of color, I think, and performers who really become symbols of something eventually, either in terms of the quality of their work or the images of the roles that they present, and particularly on television where you're in people's homes on a constant basis, and even more so for children's television where young people's absorption of those images and their identification with you as something either positive or negative, I think, has a lasting impact. And it actually didn't occur to me fully until after I had one experience, which I talk about in the book. Between taping seasons, I took a job on a soap opera playing a pimp on all my children. They liked the job I was doing so much, they kept me on for a year, and I was actually doing both roles simultaneously, Tyrone, the pimp, and Gordon of Sesame Street. And you can imagine the response of some of the parents who were watching maybe with their kids in the room when all of a sudden they saw Gordon, you know, bitch-slapping somebody.
And well, so Sesame Street, finally, the producers finally said, you got to make a choice.
Yeah, they said, no, you can't do both. So I... took what I thought was the only sensible choice, and I stayed on Sesame Street.
You haven't regretted it now, have you?
Not one bit, no.
One of the fun things about the job, it seems to me, is meeting all the fascinating people who have walked onto Sesame Street over the years, actors and musicians and mm-hmm. stars and politicians. You have one hilarious little skit in there about three first ladies you met. And which one was the most interesting? Why don't you play that riddle?
Yeah, the first of my encounters with the first ladies was with Pat Nixon, whose visit was not predicted by anyone on the show, at least, none of us. It was just a surprise visit that she and one of their daughters, I think it was Tricia, came. They came with the grandchildren one day. It happened to be a day that the only two performers working were Carol Spinney as Big Bird and myself. And they were especially looking forward to meeting Big Bird, the grandchildren especially. And I spent quite a number of minutes and probably a few hours on the set with Mrs. Nixon.
And what was she like?
She was extremely gracious and down to earth. I mean, we really began to kind of bond in a way. We talked about parenthood and grandparenthood. And
she didn't have that plastic Pat Nixon smile on the whole time.
No, she was. She kind of broke through that veneer and really seemed to relax. This was a few years after the debacle of her husband's presidency, and she seemed to be at another stage of in life.
And compare that to the two other first ladies.
Well, the next one that I met was the first Mrs. Bush, first lady,
Barbara.
Her visit was very heralded by all involved as an effort for her to spread the issue of literacy among young children. So she came in, and we were all expecting her to be there. I came in the studio after all of her Secret Service had arrived, and I was sitting in the makeup room. We were all waiting for her to come in. I was facing the mirror, and she came up behind me with her arms extended, and I assumed that she wanted a hug or whatever. She came up and reached her hands up to my bald head and began rubbing it.
And that's a kind of a racist gesture.
Well, most African Americans will recognize that as a form of condescension that comes from the old Southern ways of rubbing a black boy's head for good luck or whatever. I mean, it was a very racist head.
And did you instantly kind of flinch?
My impulses were to really flinch and to have a negative response. But I realized that this situation would not allow me to express the full dimensions of what I was feeling. So
we don't have a lot of time to talk about the third first lady.
But the third first lady was Hillary Rodham Clinton, who was obviously very different from the first two and a very formidable person who I actually met the year after as well at the White House.
All business, it sounded like.
Yes, yes.
I'm speaking with Roscoe Orman, who has written this book, Sesame Street Dad, Evolution of an Actor. He's played Gordon for 32 years on Sesame Street. It's a memoir. You have a poem entitled Memoir. Mm-hmm. I'd love it if you could read it for us.
Yes, this is a poem that I actually wrote in the course of writing the book. Most of the poems were written long before and kind of introduce each chapter. This one introduces the entire book, Memoir. The pores of life's vast membrane overflow with a rapid, fluid mix of memory and fill the page, retained, recalled, forgotten, and stirred, remixed, discarded, and recovered, all there but in a new light, imbued with the shadow play of time's wise vision and age's urgent prodding. Reviewed and refined for consumption by the curious and concerned, deposited in archival sanctity, posthumously revived, revisited again and again, to be reborn in the hearts of future ages.
That's the voice of Roscoe Orman in the studio here with me, reading one of the poems. He has poems introducing each chapter here of Sesame Street Dad, Evolution of an Actor. We only have about 30 seconds left. One question I had, substantive, was you said in an interview you weren't sure that Sesame Street could even be made today.
I doubt very highly that it could in today's climate or a landscape of what it takes to be considered viable on television in terms of the kind of frenetic activity that we see on TV. There are hundreds and hundreds of channels, particularly for children, all competing for the attention of the very young viewer.
Schlocky too, though.
Yeah, and it's all really kind of on a very low common denominator of appeal.
Which must be depressing for you to see, especially because Sesame Street was a way to get out of that lowest common denominator. Roscoe Orman, thanks so much for being my guest today. It's been a real pleasure to meet you here.
Yeah,
Roscoe Orman, the author of Sesame Street Dad.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.